This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. When a massive earthquake rocked Haiti in 2010, at least 100,000 people died. Thousands were left without shelter, food, water, and medical care. And it's estimated that $3.5 billion of humanitarian aid has flowed into the country in the 4 years since the quake. The way those funds have been distributed, particularly by non-governmental organizations, has become a source of tension. Journalist and author Amy Willens has reported on Haiti for more than three decades, and she joins us now to talk about that. Amy, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Yes, so in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, well, let's talk about that. What were the biggest challenges, and what were the biggest needs for the people of Haiti?
Well, there were needs for orthopedic surgery, which always happens after an earthquake, especially in an urban area where things fall down on you. There was great need for rubble removal and just healthcare in general to make sure that disease didn't come into the city. But rubble removal, because the city was paralyzed by a huge amount of rubble.
So what happened? I mean, what could have been? And let's put it this way. What do you think could have been done differently?
Well, first of all, relief and reconstruction are two very different things. So in a relief situation, which is in the immediate aftermath of a disaster, you have people who come in. There's basically a relief community, a crisis caravan is what it's been called, that goes from country to country helping out after there's been a tsunami or an earthquake. And you have to have relief no matter where it is. It happened with Katrina. You had to have it in Haiti. And the relief people come in. And it depends how they behave, how they're received. But they're very necessary in every case. And in Haiti, as with Katrina, there was a little bit of that fear of the local community on the part of the relief workers. But in general, a lot of good was done by the relief people overall, if you look at it. But reconstruction was quite a different matter. So you had all these people living in earthquake camps, they were called. But essentially, after a couple of weeks of earthquake camp living, these camps began to look very much like Haitian shantytowns. And then the question was, how do you help the people living in these camps? What do you do about rebuilding the city? Do you rebuild the city on a fault? And then the other question was, how do we get them out of the camps into temporary housing?
And you talked about some of the media coverage at the time, because you've been there since the 1980s. So when this happened, I'm wondering what your take on the media accounts of what was going on in Haiti. What were you seeing?
Well, the media, as usual in the United States, the media tends to follow the received wisdom. And the received wisdom about Haiti that the NGOs and also the U.S. government promulgated was this idea that there would be massive looting, as with Katrina. And this is because it was an African-American population in Haiti, as they feared in New Orleans. It was the same kind of the racist underpinning that went with the relief and reconstruction efforts. So that what happened was you'd have the relief people and the reconstruction people all living in their own area, blocked off from the Haitians they were having to help because they were afraid they'd be injured, that there would be unrest, that there would be looting. We sent in the 82nd Airborne because that was how we felt we should deal with this situation. Rather than, you know, using that money for a humanitarian effort, there was a security effort going on in Haiti to protect private property, essentially.
So there's one question kind of with the general population, but other questions about corruption in Haiti, and certainly that has been a problem. You've been covering corruption within the Haitian government, which led to questions of how is this aid going to be distributed, right?
Right. You know, it's a long story, corruption in Haiti and corruption in the Haitian government. And I argue in my book about the post-earthquake situation that the corruption of the Haitian government has come about over a long historical period in which this government has essentially been created to be corrupt. So it is actually functioning the way it was intended to function, which is as a sieve through which monies pour so that business can be conducted the way businesses want to conduct their business in Haiti. Outside governments can operate their embassies the way they want to, and the Haitian government is essentially shoved to the side by being paid a corruption fee. And that's what the government was for. But then the argument comes up in an aid situation. So the outsiders, basically, and I will just say the United States government over its sordid, torrid history with Haiti, have functioned to create a corrupt government, because you don't just have corrupted people, you have corruptors too. It's a takes two to tango situation. And then when something happens in Haiti, they call up this corruption to say to justify why they won't put money through the Haitian government to the Haitian people. And they're not wrong entirely, because it will – the Haitian government will steal money, because that's why it's there.
Yeah, and as you say, the United States government and our foreign policy from the very beginning in the 19th century certainly is not without blame in creating some of this environment.
We've encouraged corruption, I would say, and then also in the 19-year U.S. occupation of Haiti, the same thing. And it was – at that time, the Haitian government was pretty much taught not to be an independent government.
Tell us more about preconceived ideas about who the Haitian people are and their practices.
Well, this is essentially what my book is about, is the way foreigners, especially Americans, view the Haitian people. And it's a very slave time outlook that the Americans have. So it's antebellum outlook, in which they see Haitians as fearsome people who have been held in check by outside forces. But essentially, if you let them go, if you let them behave the way they would normally behave, they will be, you know, according to the kind of lingo, primitive, African, voodoo, worshiping, slave, snake training, crazy people who are not Christian.
There's even an epithet among journalists for the sort of the man in the street in
right, which Haiti. Is Fred Voodoo. And that's the title of my book. The title of my book is Farewell Fred Voodoo, because that's the Joe Sixpack of Haiti, according to outside journalists.
You're an outside journalist. How do you cover Haiti? How do you do it?
Well, I was really lucky. When I first came down to Haiti, I was already a francophone to an extent, so I spoke French. And I learned Haitian Creole because I thought it was interesting. I lived in a kind of Haitian neighborhood in New York City, people who had fled Duvalier. And so I learned Haitian Creole for, 2 months before I went down to Haiti. But I had a little bit of it. And then I was lucky enough to see the fall of the Duvalier dynasty in the first 2 weeks I was there. So I was forever hooked to the country. And then I got a book contract and I lived there for 2 years. And I think that forever changed my perspective on Haiti and made me more of a sort of insider than my colleagues in the media who come in, you know, who, as an editor of mine used to say, who parachute in and parachute out for every news story.
The parachuting out is a funny picture.
I know. But, that's what I always loved about the expression.
do you have to check against this? I mean, you can try to understand more. You can inculcate yourself and become familiar. You will always be an outsider. I mean, do you have to check against your biases and find yourself – do you catch yourself now and then?
Well, yeah. I mean, as I get older, too, I'm less involved in the people's struggle and more involved in my own comfort, so that I'm less in the shanty towns and in the earthquake camps than I would have been as a young journalist. But it's so easy to keep with my understanding of Haiti because the outsiders so don't understand it that I'm always kind of put in this position of school marm, you know, teaching my colleagues in the foreign press how to think about it a little bit. But they're learning a lot. I think the earthquake was really a learning situation for the outside press and what followed after the earthquake. And the behavior of the outsider community in Haiti, watched by the journalists, was a real lesson to the journalists in what was really happening in Haiti.
How about the Haitian population, if you could characterize it at all in general, their response to the outside response and to media coverage of their nation?
Well, I'd like to talk about how, you know, Americans go down to Haiti to have an interesting experience and see what poverty is really like and to try to help, because we're really good people. And we see ourselves as kind of decent, upstanding helpers with a lot of know-how who are working hard for Haitians. And Haitians look at the Americans who come in and they see teenagers in summer camp or resume builders who are there and don't know what the heck is going on at all. So it's two very different images.
And it seems to me, I mean, some NGOs seem to be taking this seriously and understanding that, and unless you really ask people what they want, you're not going to do much good. But the other side of that and the critique of the modern NGO, especially the European, American, European-based, is that they become their own industries. It's about what they do, and it stops being about, you know, the places where they work.
Right. One of the most cynical things you see, and it's not even done with an understanding of the cynicism implicit, is people who go out, you know, there's a famous journalist expression, anyone here been raped and speaks English? That's what the American journalist comes in shouting in, say, Vietnam. But I say, anyone here been raped and would like to be photographed for our fundraising effort? You know, so that's what happens with NGOs. You're counting victims. You're amassing victims so that you can justify your costs and fundraise. And it becomes a cynical, self-serving endeavor, and the Haitians understand, so that the person who's been raped may not have been raped, but
you're also framing the crisis in terms of what your expertise is. So if it's about reconstruction or water or orthopedics or something, then that becomes the crisis. And as you say, I guess people respond to that. They say, well, if you're looking for somebody with a broken leg, you know.
Well, that's why there was so much money flooding in from individuals right after the earthquake, because the images you see are of people with broken legs, people under the rubble, little children who are hurt and dust covered. And so, so much money comes in immediately after, and people want to take advantage of that right away. As the earthquake recedes into the distance, the money slows down to a trickle because the video images aren't as good anymore.
Anybody doing it right?
Well, I always say the doctors. You know, doctors have it very easy on this front because doctors really obviously help. So the medical people I tend to really like, with the exception of the International Red Cross that scaled up in Haiti way too fast. They had like 13 people on the ground when the earthquake struck, and then they got billions of dollars through earthquake fundraising, and then they didn't know how to spend it. It's still, a lot of it is in the bank. So they're not really doctors. They're different. They're an international organization. But smaller organizations like Partners in Health, there is a woman I write about who was just a tuberculosis doctor who happened to come in after the earthquake and then built up a tuberculosis facility in the National Hospital. And now she started a fund. And she goes from – she always starts very small. Her name is Dr. Megan Coffey. And she has a group called TKI now. And they start very small. They don't offer a lot of money to people. Mostly they offer care only. And I think the in-kind NGOs are the ones who are going to succeed the most.
Amy, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Nice talking with you.
Amy Willens is an author and journalist. She recently spoke at Duke as part of the Forum for Scholars and Publics. And her most recent book is Farewell to Fred Voodoo. It was nominated for the 2013 National Book Critics Circle Award. You can find out more about Amy, her visit, and her book at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Sean Wen, and Megan Mataferi. Robin Copley is the technical director, Brent Wolf the news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.